Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you again for attending the third day of the ICLDC and the first session. Today, Julia Salabank will be presenting a paper titled Language Revitalization, Issues and Outcomes.
Okay, bonjour, merci la Julia. I'm hoping for visa at Tour Arabic 3, de Logo d'Angers. So I'm Julia, I'm going to be talking to you about the revitalization of languages in danger. And that was in my language, which is Genesier of the Channel Islands, which is a Norman dialect. Oh, thank you. So first of all, this is theoretical framing. I'm going to talk a bit about what it might mean to save a language. What does it mean to us? What does it mean to the people that we're working with? Many of us here are doing language documentation. The title of this conference includes the word conservation. And to many lay people, including people that I work with, that equates to the P word, preservation, which many of them equate to preserving a language in a static manner as something which is of the past in a museum. And many people I work with would like to see their languages going on as living languages. And language revitalization can be defined rather literally as activities which restore or increase the vitality of a language. That's another whole talk in itself, what do we mean by vitality? But it's not only things like dictionaries, grammars, the kind of things that documentary linguists think of as the application of their documentary research. It's what you do with those and what you can also do without those. Because many of the people that I work with don't think that it's necessary to do documentation. Oh, we've still got speakers, they say. Not many. Revitalization is generally driven by the community. There was a very interesting talk yesterday on what we mean by community, and I'm going to talk about that a very little bit. Again, it's a bit of a side issue here, but who in the community has control of that is a very valid issue in language revitalization. In any kind of language planning, any kind of planning, really, you need to have your aims, and really your strategies should emerge from the aims. But in language revitalization, people get really enthusiastic. We've got to save our language. We've got to do something about our language. And they don't actually think often about the short-term or the long-term aims of what they're doing. And so there tends to be a little bit of mismatch between aims and actual activities. And aims are often not even articulated clearly at all. So I want to think about, particularly because I'm interested in the people, that we work with and how they think about language. What do they understand by saving a language? And for that, we need to take into account the attitudes they have towards language, the language ideologies, what they think language is, what they think language should do, and the discourses they have, the way they talk about language. And there has been a little bit of discussion about this in the academic literature. Apologies if you're familiar with this already. Joshua Fishman, the grandfather of language revitalization, if you like, the main factor, the important factor in language revitalization is using the language in the family. But this is coming to be challenged more and more, or at least problematized more and more in the field. Because although many revitalization movements think of this as one of their aims, in fact, that's not what they're doing. And many people would say, actually, that may not be a realistic aim for a highly endangered language in the modern world, to have it as the primary medium of socialization. And Susanna Main has queried whether in the future linguistic diversity will be maintained by different patterns of reproduction, especially schools and adult learning and teaching, and it tends to be schools that most revitalization movements focus on. So we have to think about whether that actually is saving a language. Moving on from that, Nick Tiberger, who is speaking in the next session, has noted that in Australia, even the idea of speaking language fluently isn't necessarily a aim for some language revitalization movements. And for some people, because what they're interested in is valorizing their language, getting people to think of their language as something that has a value in itself and which has a value for them as people, just having a few phrases that they can use in a ritual or in greetings is actually enough for them in terms of language revitalization. So, you know, of these and many and other possible aims, what's actually happening in the communities that we work with? And this is the case study I'm going to focus on. The Channel Islands, I realised I should have had a wider map because it's a bit Eurocentric, this map. But basically, they're in. Can you see that?
Uh-uh.
No. Perhaps we could have some lights off at this end. Is that possible? Anyway, they're in the English Channel between Britain and France. And they, if you can see the map, you will see that they are much closer, come on, to France than they are to Britain. About four times closer. No, that doesn't really work. Okay, never mind. Oh dear, I've got rather a lot of photos, so I hope you're going to be able to see them. I think it's this side we need to turn off a bit. Okay, I'll just go on anyway. So politically, they are affiliated to Britain, but they are, well, quasi autonomous. They have their own parliaments, they have their own laws. Jersey is the biggest island. It's about 15 miles long at its longest point. Guernsey is the second largest island. Jersey has its own parliament, its own government. Guernsey has its own government, which also controls the other islands, the smaller islands, Orkney, Sark, Hermans, and various other rocks. All of these islands have or had their own language varieties, to a degree mutually intelligible, but not totally mutually intelligible. And they're all varieties of Norman, which is one of the wheel or oil language family of northern France. In Alderney, the language died out in about the 1960s. In Sark, Sedshire is spoken perhaps by about 15 people now. I've been doing some documentation work there. I'll talk a little bit more about language vitality on the main islands later. But in terms of population, Guernsey has about 62,000 people, Jersey 90,000. They are small islands, but they are quite densely populated. And they have belonged to Normandy for about 1,200 years, and they were part of Normandy when Normandy invaded England in 1066. So basically, really, England belongs to us, not the other way around. Because I consider myself a community member as well. My mother comes from Guernsey, my father grew up there. And they're well known for dairy cattle, Guernsey and Jersey cows, heavily exported to America. Sweaters, Jersey has become synonymous with a woolen sweater. Tomatoes were a major export up until the end of the 20th century. But now the major industries are tourism and finance. They are low-tax jurisdictions. They do not like the word tax haven. And they're also well known for being the only part of the British Isles. Well, they're part of the British Isles, but not part of the UK, and not part of Great Britain. they were the only part of the British Isles occupied by the Germans in World War II, so you get a lot of TV programmes and stuff about that. And a lot of my consultants, I went to the oral history session yesterday, a lot of my consultants would talk about the Second World War as a major thing that happened in their lives, obviously. As I said this, there are varieties of Norman, but the majority language is now English because of the political links. But from the 16th to the 19th centuries, French was the high language in a diglossic situation. And then English came into that kind of triglossic situation. French has never been widely spoken. It's always learned through education, but it still retains high prestige, and that affects the revitalisation situation, which I'm not going to go into a lot on that one. Just say we have great beaches too. This is in the north of Guernsey. Oh dear. This is in the south of Guernsey, and this one's in the south of Jersey. In terms of language vitality, they're not quite as warm as the beaches here, by the way. the sea's bloody cold. Gerier and Genesier, Gerier is the language of Jersey, Genesier of Guernsey, palatalisation, are classed as severely endangered by UNESCO, but I think they're nearer to critically endangered because the youngest speakers are grandparents and older. I was thinking about this last night. I think I'm actually the fourth youngest speaker who's anything near fluent, and I'm a grandmother. And I don't speak it a lot. So, yeah, that's about where we are. And we reckon that there are about 300, or maybe under 300, fluent speakers now, fluent elderly speakers of each of these. And the fluent ones are in their 80s, 90s, even some of them over 100. On the same time, you're getting as the vitality goes down, the attitudes towards these varieties are getting more and more positive amongst the general population, and people are in favour of saving the languages, but they don't know what that means. They're not officially recognised, however. They're not part of the school curricula. And so I think that in the next couple of decades will be quite crucial in terms of language survival, because most of the traditional speakers will have gone, and there aren't at the moment many new younger speakers. Oops, okay, better hurry up. Okay, in Jersey, the language policy, there has been government support for the last 15 years or so, and there are three language officers who run the language programme there. They run lessons in schools only once a week, however, and not part of the curriculum. Well, their language awareness is part of the citizenship programme now. That's just started this year. There's increasing amount of public signage in what we call the linguistic landscape, mostly in tourist areas, however. They have a big website, about 3,000 pages in Jerry, which is quite an achievement. And a lot of effort and funding has gone into that. They also have a school leaving examination, what we call GCSE in the UK. But, however, nobody has passed it yet. The problem is that they've been running this programme since 1998. They spent £1 million, about $1,600, I think. $1 million, and they haven't got a single fluent learner, which is a problem. Okay, and they tend to evaluate it in terms of number of web pages, number of speakers, rather than how well they're doing. In Guernsey, again, there are extracurricular lessons, but they're run by volunteers. They're not supported by the government. And these volunteers are retired. They have no teacher training. There isn't any standard spelling or standard of Genesier. There is for Jersey, more or less. And there aren't really any lessons beyond elementary level, again, in Guernsey either. There's a big focus among particularly traditional speakers on language festivals, performance in those festivals. And I'll come back to that in a minute. I've got a picture of that. There's increasing amount of government rhetoric in favour of language revitalisation in Guernsey. And there was a language officer appointed in 2008, however resigned 3 years later because of the infighting within the language movements on the island, which is something that happens a lot in language revitalisation. But just a few weeks ago, the government announced an exciting new strategy for language, but we don't know many details of that yet. Okay. So with regard to both of these, I want to look in a bit more detail about what the aims and rationales are of the activities that are going on, and the ideologies that drive them. What do people think they're doing when they're doing these language so-called revitalization activities? So here is a picture of some of the traditional speakers, or some of them don't actually speak very much, it's just a thing. This is a language festival that happens every year, and it rotates between Guernsey, Jersey, and mainland Normandy, because they consider themselves part of a Norman language continuum. And you can see that they are dressed in what you might call generic old-fashioned clothes. And it does tend to give younger people an impression that this is the language of the past. And even for the people here, they think of it as the language of their youth, not as something that is taken forward into the future. So, but for these people, performance is really the be-all and end-all of what they do for the language, what they do in the language, as we even. Most of them can speak it fluently. I know most of these people personally. Most of them can speak it fairly fluently, but they don't speak it at home normally. We have kids. These are kids performing in the same festival. This is in 2009. This was 2003. Again, they've learnt it as a set piece. They don't necessarily understand what they're saying, and they certainly don't speak it at home. Some of them have grandparents who speak the language, but some of them may speak the language to them once they know they're learning in schools, but the trouble is, particularly in Jersey, that they're learning a standardised version in the schools, which isn't necessarily the same as the dialects that their grandparents are speaking. And the grandparents will, either the grandparents will say, oh, we don't say it like that, you're doing it wrong, or they'll say, oh, you're learning the correct version, I'm speaking it wrong. And both ways, the communication tends to stop. In what we call the linguistic landscape, there are, as I said, there are signposts in Jersey. This one, sorry about the quality of the pictures. This one is a trilingual sign, English, French, and Gerrier, in the capital, St Helier. It's got a list of street names in English and Gerrier, because most of the streets were renamed into English. Not necessarily translated, but renamed in the 19th century, and this is telling people what they used to be. And there is an increasing use of Jiri. The language office tries to promote the use of Jiri in various domains, and this is saying that you can promote your particularly local products using local language. This is a cider. Cider is a big thing in Normandy. Okay. The Guernsey politician who is championing the language in the new language initiative has called this a flagship presence. He wants to see the language. In Jersey, they've got the language appearing. I don't think you see it anywhere on that. On banknotes, and he figures this is good because this is something that circulates widely. It's something small, but everyone sees it. Okay, but when you look at this in terms of language, what you see is French. Up the top, States of Jersey. That's the Isle of Parliament. The States it's called, which is very confusing when you're in America. £1 in French, and then right in the corner, £1 in Gerier, very small. And Louis. And in Guernsey, there have been some stamps with bits of language on, we might call it, odd phrases, nominally in a French spelling, but not necessarily. I'll continue more about this. La Pochon means goodbye, bonjour, hello, what I said at the beginning, au tivla is there you are. Oyus, they translated it as good gracious, it means listen. Corchapin, corblime, it means fruit loaf. And it replaces a swear word. And la fête vatale is how are things, how are you? Okay. These are not standard stamps. They were a special issue, so they're not something that's circulating generally at the moment. The mission statement, sorry again about this. I took this from the wall of the Jersey Language Office. This is the mission statement. The objective of the Jiri program in schools is to ensure the survival of Jersey's own language for the benefit of future generations by capturing the imagination of students with the colour, piquancy and vigour of Jiri. So this is going to ensure the survival of the language, right? Yeah. I want to pull together the themes that have come. I've been looking at this over the last 13 years or so, and these are things that I've been thinking about that have been coming up throughout the research. First of all, you tend to find a focus on formal education. And this is a general thing you find in language revitalization movements. We've got to get our language into the schools, they say. Why? What's going to happen then? Yeah. And how are you going to do it? technical fixes, this is a phrase from Dauenhauer and Dauenhauer's paper. If you haven't read the book by Eleanor and Whaley, please do. This is like the websites in Jersey focus on electronic learning instead of just speaking the language, which really is the best way to say the language, just speak it. The politicians in the islands, what they're interested in language is really to promote their islands as something distinctive, for tourism, in competition with other financial jurisdictions, that kind of thing. There tends to be a lack of what Fishman calls prior ideological clarification, any kind of ideological clarification, let alone prior. Okay. As I said earlier, people don't tend to specify their goals, whether they're short-term or long-term. We just want to save the language, they say. What do you mean by that? But what is good about the new Guernsey initiative is that they are trying to at least specify what they want to see in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Which is, I think, a sign of progress. In both islands, there are issues to do with authority and correctness in language, both in the language itself and in language policy. there's a lot of fear among the people, a group of older people who call themselves traditionalists, about language change, and in some cases, they're more afraid of language change than they are of language death. And there's people at the beginning who all dress up in old clothes who they consider the language to be their language, the language of their youth, and they don't want that memory to change. Which means that, and they are very powerful in the community. They have a lot of prestige and in some cases political power as well. And which means that younger learners don't necessarily get a look in when it comes to making language policy, but that may be changing in Guernsey as well. But at the same time as having this view of language as something of the past, it's also what is called a modernist or Western model of language and what language does, which comes out in the function of school, in the focus on schools, in the idea that you've got to have written language, you've got to have a standard language in order to be a proper language. So this is the last slide. What do we mean by saving a language? And I have tried to ask people what they think they mean, what they think they're doing. There are so many different stakeholders involved, and this is not only true in the islands, but you know, but in other places as well. We've got the traditional speakers. Most of them simply want to be allowed to speak. Language owners I talked about. New speakers is a term that's coming up in the field more and more. People who have learned it as a second language, often who speak it more often than the older speakers. You've got people who grew up with a language, I don't like this term semi-speakers, but people who grew up hearing the language don't necessarily have passive knowledge of the grammar and stuff, but they don't necessarily have the confidence to speak. But some of them are trying to reactivate that knowledge. You've got learners, you've got supporters who aren't going to learn, but they can be useful with things like web skills, other kind of skills, money, stuff they can provide, and politicians as well, who've got their own agenda and not much knowledge about language or policy either. They all have different goals and understandings. When I asked one of the Jersey language officers what he thought saving the language was, he says, oh, increasing the number of speakers. So I said, okay, so what you're doing, is that actually increasing the number of speakers? Oh, he says. Yeah, he never thought about that. So we got this, we've got to get language into the schools, but not thinking beyond that. How are we going to do it, or you know, what's it going to lead to? But interestingly, in these islands, nobody even mentions the use of language in the family. That is simply not even thought about. And there is less and less informal language use. It's mostly thought of as formal lessons. And even someone said to me, how can you learn a language without reading and writing? So I said, how did you learn your language in the first place? Yeah. Yeah. And as I said, performance tends to be seen as an end in itself, it's rather than speaking. In both islands, I do feel the documentation is urgent, and I've been doing documentation in Guernsey. I have had some ELDP funding, and now the government has started at last to fund the former language officer, who's also my research assistant, to do some documentation there as well. But no language documentation is being done in Jersey at the moment. So if, and probably when, the revitalization effort fails and all the native speakers die, there will not be a lot left. But I do think that for a highly endangered language, the future lies with second language speakers. And therefore, there is a need for both effective teaching and learning, and also for those learners to be empowered to take the language forward in their own terms. Thank you. Merci.
Thank you, Julia, for your presentation. Any questions or comments?
So is the status of these islands, is it similar to that of the Isle of Man? It's a crown dependency?
Yes.
And I was, so
like,
I have
like,
a,
like Monaco, like Cayman Islands, something, yeah.
Okay. Well, I had kind of a two-part question.
Yeah.
So how does the relative autonomous status of the islands help or hinder these revitalization efforts? And is there any influence or help from France, since it's closer, or none at all?
Oh gosh, that's a lot of stuff there. Originally, until very recently, there's been no government interest at all in language. And one of the reasons, I think, is that they didn't need language as a symbol of independence, because they had been independent since 1204, since King John lost the French lands. And they, anyway, it's a long story. So they've been independent for 800 years, so they don't need language as a symbol of gaining independence. They are not part of the European Union, so they don't get European funding. There is European funding for regional languages in Europe now, but they don't get that because they're not part of that. But they do have, and they do have the power to control their own education curricula, for example, but they don't. They tend to follow the British, the English system, not even the Welsh system. They could go for bilingual education, but they don't. Okay, does that answer your questions?
Yeah, but from France?
For France, there is a link with the Norman Cultural Centre, and I mentioned that there's this link with mainland Normandy in terms of language, well, kind of maintenance rather than revitalisation. But no, there's no real, because France itself is not terrifically interested in regional languages.
Right.
No.
Thank you.
So yes, sorry.
Thanks for your presentation. I think it's really interesting to see how much the issues in old Europe are similar to those in, for want of a better term, the post-colonial societies where we're facing exactly the same issue.
And the Jersey accent's just like yours.
I'm sorry?
The Jersey accent is just like yours.
Oh, yeah. harking back to the kind of big picture level and looking at the idea of revitalisation, I wonder, do you think, or what do you think of the suggestion that in trying to take in non-intergenerational, non-natural intergenerational transmission and use of language as a badge of honour rather than any definite function, redefining revitalisation to, you know, kind of on a Me Too basis actually waters down what we mean, because I would maybe suggest that those uses are in fact non-vital, and that the language is vital. It has functional uses outside of the schools, say, and there's some form of intergenerational transmission. So I think it's a problematic thing that old, you know, language transmission through schools is suddenly naturalised and that's vital, and badge of honour use is, oh, that's vital, and
I think you're right, yes. Interesting, I was talking to a guy here who teaches Hawaiian the other day, and he said he considers immersion teaching to be life support rather than living language, which I thought was a very interesting way of putting it. Because it's,
say
it's,
that again, please.
Immersion teaching is as life support, not actually living. Because what they found in Wales is that they get kids who've been through the whole education system through Welsh, and they don't carry on speaking it because it's a school thing.
Yes.
It's like, I never wanted to read John Steinbeck again, because I had to read him at school. He did it. Yeah.
I think Fishman uses the term, if your first step is to put language into schools, you've kind of
missed the boat.
Shot yourselves in the foot.
But everyone does it.
Yeah. I don't remember the exact term he used.
But everyone ignores him.
Yes, it's very
good.
So you say everyone ignores Fishman, so that means you emphatically stated at the end that you believe in second language learning, and you want to grab the bull by the horns. And so, could you give an example of what's happening in second language learning?
The example that I know best of somewhere that I think is getting to be relatively successful is the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man, which you mentioned, it's another island which is between England, Scotland, and Ireland. And it's got it's a similar size and a similar political setup.
Probably more dire than your Jersey.
The last speaker died in the 1970s.
Right.
And there was a group of adults who learnt the language fluently, and for them it did become their primary language.
How did they become second? That's my question.
They learned it by speaking to the older speakers. They went round with the linguists.
Similar to mentoring.
Yes.
Apprenticeships.
And that's how I've learnt it. And then really, the only people I know who've become fluent is by speaking to all the speakers.
But when there is no native speaker left, that's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, they speak to each other. These people have their own little community. At the time they were young, they decided to raise their children through MACS. They lobbied and eventually started a school, but that's another story. But they have actually restarted intergenerational transmission. They have neo speakers now in the Isle of Man.
Well, that would be nice if you could connect before you leave. Like if you've already left.
Well, the thing is that what they say, and this is a bit controversial, is that the older people tend to have quite negative attitudes towards the language. And even the ones who are nominally involved in language revitalization activities, they still feel that their language is inferior. And what someone in the Isle of Man said to me is actually, I said to him, how did you get the attitudes turned around? He said, all those other people died.
Well, in Hawaii, as that person you spoke to about life, this lifeline, actually, immersion is not a good word. Hawaii medium education probably is better word.
Right.
That's a lifeline. And I think many indigenous languages of the world need to have lifelines.
But you have to also have something else to go with that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As your talk is about, there's more to it than just one way of doing it.
Because what they found in Wales is the kids, that what they're now doing is those kids who've got a basis in Welsh, they're doing childcare education with them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. We have time for one short question.
You mentioned that since in Jersey and the Channel Islands, language, how is language seen as a factor of identity, or isn't it?
The jumping logic goes. Look at all these buildings and these shops. It looks just like England. What have we got that's ours? It's our language, but we're losing it, so we've got to keep it. It's seen as something that is distinctive, which defines the island. This is not politically correct according to many people now in my field, but this is how people feel. And even people who don't speak the language feel very strongly that it should be maintained.
So it's not personal identity, it's more place.
There's a bit of both. For the politicians, it's more defining the place, and for some people, it's defining. For me personally, when I speak the language, I get this warm, fuzzy feeling, and that's why I love it, and I can connect with that. And for me, it's not a dying language. It's something I use regularly. But when I go there, I stay with a guy who's trying to reactivate. He's a semi-speaker. And so we speak it all the time.
Yeah. Speak it to your kids?
Not my kids. No, I think I learned it when my family were what some people here called assimilators, very anti the language, because people were ashamed of it, and people thought it wasn't modern, and they had to learn English to get ahead. So my parents didn't speak it, but I did hear it when I was young. So when I started studying it, I've always been fascinated by it. And when I started studying it, I felt a connection, and I felt that I always could remember. I got flashbacks of scenes from my childhood, yeah? Yeah. This connection is quite important, is what you're talking about. Yeah. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Julia.